KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is December 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
On 89.3 KPCC, a very good morning to you. I'm Larry Mantle. Welcome to Air Talk. For the next 36-some minutes, we're going to talk about the election results, specifically here in Southern California, also the major national trends. You just heard in a news conference lasting well over an hour, President Trump lashing out at Republicans who distanced themselves from him. Also, you heard his criticism of news media, which has been a standard part of any of the news conference that he's had, particularly pointed this time around, though. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it'll be a statewide call-in program, part of our California Dream collaboration, California Public Radio Stations, and the nonprofit news organization Cal Matters. That's coming up in our 11 o'clock hour right here on 89.3 KPCC. The president in that news conference said that Republicans defied history in the midterms. He talked about the additional seats that Republicans appear to have picked up in the Senate. At the same time, the House of Representatives, of course, now with a Democratic majority. In the White House East Room news conference, the president also warning Democrats about spending the remaining years of his presidency investigating him and the administration. He talked about working bipartisanly on a number of initiatives, but very pointedly said that wouldn't be happening if Democrats launched investigations. Joining us to talk about the president's news conference as well as the overall results, Caltech professor of political science Michael Alvarez. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So first, the president's comments, he seems particularly delighted despite the fact the House has gone Democratic.
Well, I think that, again, like most elections these days, there seems to be a lot for both sides to be happy about. I think Democrats are happy that they've retaken the House, and we still do have a number of outstanding races, so their margin come January could be even larger. On the other hand, you know, I think that Trump is pretty happy with the fact that Republicans did quite well in a number of Senate races, in particular in Senate races where he had put a lot of energy and his personal stake in those.
All right. Michael Alvarez with us. We have a wide range of guests who will be joining us. Now we listen to Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi.
People. The biggest winner in yesterday was the health care for American people, for our seniors, and hardworking American families. Healthcare was on the ballot, and healthcare won. Yesterday, Americans elected an extraordinary class of dynamic and diverse Democratic candidates, members elected who reflect their districts and who embody the bountiful diversity of our nation. Women led the way to victory, with at least 30 new women coming to the Congress. Is that not exciting? And there's still some races that are not finalized yet, so there could be more. Democrats also secured big wins in the governorships across the country. And while it is my responsibility to win the House for the Democrats, winning the governorships is essential to good policy in our country and open elections and the rest. So victories in Wisconsin, Illinois, Kansas, Maine, Michigan, New Mexico, and Nevada. We're very proud in New Mexico that our colleague, Michelle Lujan Grisham, is now the governor. In Colorado, Jared Polis is now the governor, our current colleague, even though that's replacing a Democratic governor, a great governor, Governor Hickenlooper. So that wasn't a pickup, but it is a Democratic member there. Tim Walz in Minnesota, our colleague, again, winning in Minnesota. So for us, just seeing that the extraordinary leadership of these members going into governor's offices, seeing the increased number of Democratic governorships, it was a great night for the American people. We won because from the beginning, we focused on health care. 2 years ago today, the day after the election, not the same date, but the same day after the election, everyone came together and said, We see the urgency. We want to take responsibility, and that gave us opportunity to protect the Affordable Care Act. That was so essential to the health and financial security of America's working families, and we knew it would be a target of the Trump administration. So just for you know that by that Sunday, we had mobilized many of the groups outside. They were self-mobilized as well, but we all came together, depending on where, despite where we might be on the spectrum on other issues, to say this was our focus. We made a plan to launch our campaign on the weekend of Martin Luther King Day, you know when that is, in January, and we did. After the president's inauguration, as you know, something historic happened in our country, the Women's March, and much of that was about health care, women's reproductive health. Excuse me. Healthcare, the beat goes on. Over the course of that next year and a half, working with the outside groups, and they deserve a great deal of credit, and I'm proud of our democratic unity in the Congress of the United States and our inside maneuvering, that unity was essential to the clarity of our message and our differentiation from the Republicans on that subject. But working together, voting together, we were able to make our case. The outside groups, and we participated in some of this, but the outside groups had 10,000 events across the country speaking out about the risk that was involved in Republican policy in terms of health care in our country. Their assaults on Medicare, Medicaid, their assaults on the benefit of a pre-existing medical condition being taken away, all of that, so much more. The issue about the cost of prescription drugs, all of those issues by groups, coalitions, HCAN, Protect Our Care, little lobbyists, advocacy groups of patient advocacy groups across the country, labor unions, veterans, the list goes on and on of so many people who were involved in that. Leading up to this being on the ballot, and with people, some of you have said to me, how did this emerge as the issue in the campaign? My answer is, we made our own environment because we knew how important healthcare is, not only to the good health of families, but to the financial well-being of their families, healthcare cost being such a major assault on their economic security. And when we put together our For the People agenda, our first priority was to lower the health care cost by lowering the cost of prescription drugs. Leader Mitch McConnell went forth and really admitted that Medicare and Medicaid and some aspects of Social Security disability benefits were on the chopping block. The president pulled his punch when it came time to lowering the cost of prescription drugs by enabling the secretary to negotiate for that. So this is very important. That was for the people, lower health care costs, bigger paychecks by building the infrastructure of America, integrity in government by reducing the role of big dark money in the political spectrum. That was our agenda. Our candidates ran with it. But health care, health care, health care in every household in America is an important issue. The man whose office I occupy now, Speaker Tip O'Neill, he said all politics is local. When it comes to health care, all politics is personal. And so, again, we made our own environment. While the GOP tried relentlessly to distract and divide, our candidates kept their focus on that subject. And when I say our candidates for re-election as well. Voters delivered a resounding verdict against congressional Republicans' attacks on Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act and people with pre-existing conditions in districts everywhere in America. They went in a new direction, a House that will, now they want a new direction, a House that will work to make progress in the lives of America's families and seniors. Democrats pledge, again, a new majority, our For the People agenda, lower health care costs, lower prescription drugs, bigger paychecks, building the infrastructure. clean up corruption to make America work for the American people's interest, not the special interest. Yesterday's election was not only a vote to protect America's health care, it was a vote to restore the health of our democracy. The health of our democracy. Under the Constitution, I'm proud that the legislative branch is the Article I, the first branch of government, the legislative branch. Right after that beautiful preamble stating our purpose, Article I, the legislative branch, there as a co-equal branch of the other branches of government and a check and balance on other branches of government. American people want to put an end to unchecked GOP control of Washington, restoring again the checks and balances envisioned by our founders. That's a responsibility we have when we take that oath to protect and defend the Constitution. And we as Democrats are here to strengthen the institution in which we serve and not to have it be a rubber stamp for President Trump. House Democrats will honor our responsibility to the Constitution, as I said, have a conscience. How we will do things, we will open the Congress with a rule that will insist upon openness and transparency so that the American people can see the impact of public policy on their lives. Putting an end to what the Republicans did with their tax scam in the dark of night with speed of light, no hearings on a bill that would have trillions of dollars of impact on our economy. That's over. We will strive in that openness with American people as our partners because they will see the impact of legislation on their lives. We will strive for bipartisanship. We believe that we have a responsibility to seek common ground where we can. Where we cannot, we must stand our ground, but we must try. And so by openness and transparency, accountability, bipartisanship, a very important part of how we will go forward. We believe that's a responsibility we have to honor the vision of our founders. They gave us, in their declaration, a call for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How beautiful. But they also gave us guidance on how to achieve that. E pluribus unum, from many one. They couldn't imagine how many we would become or how different we would be from each other, but they knew that we had to strive for oneness, recognizing that this is a marketplace of ideas. We have different views on the role of government, and that's a healthy debate for the American people to witness and for us to have. We do so with confidence in our values and our proposals, but also with humility to listen and hear what others may have to say. And so that will be the kind of Congress that we have, one, again, that honors the guidance of E Pluribus Unum. Last night, I had a conversation with President Trump about how we could work together. One of the issues that came up was part of our For the People agenda, building the infrastructure of America, and I hope that we can achieve that. He talked about it during his campaign and really didn't come through with it in his first 2 years in office, but that issue has not been a partisan issue in the Congress of the United States. Over the years, we've been able to work together regionally, bipartisan, across the aisle, across the Capitol, and down Pennsylvania Avenue. Hope that we can do that because we want to create jobs from sea to shining sea, creating good-paying jobs, whether it's about surface transportation, water systems. My colleague, Congresswoman Eshoo, is here, a champion on broadband, always on, high-speed broadband across America to end the digital divide, especially into rural areas as well as urban areas, and then schools, housing, and the rest. Those jobs, those initiatives will create good-paying jobs, will also generate other economic growth in their regions. So we hopefully we can work in a bipartisan way in that way. The other issue that we could hopefully work on is lowering the cost of prescription drugs, and that is something the president has talked about. We had it in our 6 for 06 12 years ago when we won the House. All five of those six became law. The one we couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate for was enabling the secretary to negotiate for lower prescription drug prices. We hope to get that done now because that is a big impact on America's families' budget. And then the third really caffeinating issue for us is integrity in government, to reduce the role of dark special interest money. And I commend all of our candidates for their commitment to the health care agenda, to the bigger paycheck agenda, and also to the good government agenda. They have written letters saying that they want H.R. 1, which is our better deal for America's democracy, to be something they vote on. But I say to them, when you come here, you will have an impact on what that legislation is. You may want to make some additions or some tweaking, but nonetheless, our newcomers will be part of putting together how the agenda goes forward, and we look forward to that invigoration of the Congress. I also spoke to Leader McConnell this morning, and how we could work together, especially on infrastructure. I did receive a call of congratulations from Speaker Ryan, and I welcomed that, and we discussed how it is to win and how it is not to win in terms of this. So in any event, the concern that he was expressing was about for some of his colleagues who would no longer be serving. On that point, I want to say something, because in winning this election, not only were we on the right side of history, we're on the right side of the future. This is where we have to go. But when we talk about the challenges that we face, we had to jump over gerrymandered lines all over the country. So when we talk about our success, it's about the grassroots operation, owning the ground. All of these groups that cared about healthcare, many of them out there to help elect people who shared their value about lowering healthcare costs, moving lifetime caps, even annual caps on insurance coverage, and certainly restoring the benefit of pre-existing conditions not being a barrier to coverage. Most importantly, though, are the quality of our candidates. They're spectacular from every walk of life, and some of them from a couple of different walks of life. And when they come here, they'll bring their experience, their knowledge, and especially their values to the Congress. We look forward to that. This is no easy feat to win this election. I hear the president attributing to this, that, and the other thing. But when you think of how gerrymandered the country is, how we hope to change that, but nonetheless, how we were able to succeed in this election is a tribute again to the quality of our candidates, the determination of our grassroots folks across the country, and the values that we share with the American people. In terms of working with the president, I just would say that I worked very productively with President Bush when we had the majority and he had the presidency. We passed one of the biggest energy bills in the history of our country. We passed one of the biggest tax bills in terms of stimulus for low-income people as well as middle-income people in his presidency. And the list goes on. PEPFAR. He wanted PEPFAR. We wanted big. And there's so many issues that we worked together, even though I vehemently opposed him in the war in Iraq. But the point is that we worked together. The president said, I'll wait for them to send me something. Well, we have ideas, and we can send them something. But the fact is, if we'd like to work together so our legislation will be bipartisan. We're not going for the lowest common denominator. We're going for the boldest common denominator. Our position will be a consensus within our own party of what we can support, but also welcoming other ideas. So we look forward to a new kind of a new era in terms of what has happened. This past 2 years has seemed like a very, very long time in terms of the path that has taken us down. When I think of our founders and their courage, their vision, what they had in mind for us, e pluribus unum from anyone, when I think of the American people and how beautifully diverse we are and how newcomers to our country have constantly reinvigorated America, when I think of our beautiful planet, and, of course, our own country, God's gift to us, and how it has been neglected and degraded in this past couple of years, I think that there's plenty of opportunity for us to match our legislation with the rhetoric that we are hearing. It might surprise you.
If you're just joining us, this is NPR special coverage of first President Trump's press conference and now soon to be House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the results of the midterms.
And I won't read you the whole quote, but I'll read you just one paragraph. Ronald Reagan said, "This is the last speech that I will make as President of the United States, and I want to, it's fitting to leave one final thought and observation about a country which I love." Last speech. That's quite a headliner, right, in your business? Ronald Reagan's last speech. He said, "Thanks to each new wave of new arrivals to this land of opportunity, we're a nation forever young, forever bursting with energy and new ideas, and always on the cutting edge, always leading the world to the next frontier. This quality is vital to our future as a nation." Goes on to say, "If we ever close the door to new Americans, our leadership in the world would soon be lost." We ever close the door, our leadership would soon be lost. So in that respect for the vision of our founders, the diversity of our country, the beauty of our land, the values in our Constitution first and foremost, we think there's an opportunity to work together. One sign of good faith on the part of the president to work together was for them to withdraw their assault on the pre-existing condition benefit, which the Republican attorneys general across the country have put forth and which this administration has said they won't defend the law of the land. They'll join in that lawsuit. That's just wrong. That's just wrong. So we think, as a sign of good faith and in keeping with what they're saying on the campaign trail, prove it, withdraw the lawsuit. So that would be one place that we could start. In any event, next week we look forward to welcoming our new class of freshmen. We will celebrate their diversity, the freshness of their thinking, and the rest. And they will immediately be incorporated into our building of consensus on how we go forward in a very open, transparent, bipartisan, unifying Congress. Any questions? Yes, sir, because I didn't give you last night.
Press conference about Democratic investigation into the White House, the Trump administration. He said they could halt government. He also said that his tax returns wouldn't be released necessarily because of under continuous audit. So my question is, are you concerned about the Democratic overreach in any way in your investigations? And two, how far are you willing to take the push to get the president?
Apologize for the audio quality here of the questioning, but reporters there at the Capitol live now asking questions of Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader.
We have a constitutional responsibility to have oversight. That's the balance of power. I'm an appropriator. It was one of the places I was forged in the Congress on the Appropriations Committee as well as on the Intelligence Committee. Both places whose hallmarks were bipartisanship, nothing. We could always left to our own devices, find our solutions. That, of course, has changed now when the poison pills rain down from on high. But in appropriations and all of the other committees, we have a responsibility for oversight. And hopefully, in the course of asking for information, we can just make the request and the information will come in. We're concerned about what's happening at EPA, for example, to degrading of the air we breathe and the water we drink, despite what the president said today. So that's only one example. I don't think we'll have any scattershot freelancing in terms of this. We will have a responsibility to honor our oversight responsibilities, and that's the path that we will go down. We're again trying to unify our country. Look, when our committees, I'm a big believer in the committee system, always have been, our committees will make their decisions and make their recommendations to the caucus. But you can be sure of one thing. When we go down any of these paths, we'll know what we're doing and we'll do it right.
Just a historic number of women in Congress. 31.
We've been listening to a live news conference on Capitol Hill. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader of the House of Representatives, and with Democrats taking the majority in the House, Nancy Pelosi leading candidate to regain her former position as Speaker of the House. Not to say, though, that she might not have some competition for that position as well. Prior to hearing from Nancy Pelosi, we heard from Donald Trump, the president, in a news conference in the East Room of the White House, went very combatively against news media, was critical of Republicans who distanced themselves from him. And he also touted his success, as he put it, for the gains that Republicans appear to be making in the Senate. Of course, the Republicans lost the House of Representatives with the election results of yesterday. Just very briefly, look at the Southern California House races. There are five of these races that are not definitively decided, but four of them look very well on their way to being decided. In the 25th Congressional District, which straddles Los Angeles County, North LA County, and Ventura County, Katie Hill, the Democratic challenger to Republican incumbent Steve Knight, with 51% to 49% over Knight. In the 39th District, straddling Orange, L.A., and San Bernardino counties, this had been Ed Royce, the Republican's district. His staffer, Young Kim, also Republican, appears poised to become the first Korean-American woman member of the House of Representatives. She has a lead over Gil Cisneros, the Democrat. In the 45th District in Orange County, Mimi Walters, 52% to Katie Porter, the Democratic challenger's 48%. Walters appears poised to hold on to that seat for the Republicans. But again, there are still votes to be counted. In the 48th district, way too close to call this race, Democratic challenger Harley Ruda is leading in that coastal Orange County district over Dana Rohrabacher, the 30-year incumbent, 51 to 49%, just under 3,000 votes separate with Ruda in the lead. And in the 49th district, which had been Daryl Issa's district, North San Diego, South Orange County district, Mike Levin, the Democrat, 52% to 48% over Diane Harkey, the Republican, but only 66% of the votes are tallied. However, what's outstanding is San Diego County there, which would be expected to break toward Levin. So 7,000 votes separate them, but Levin in excellent position to take that seat for the Democrats. So it appears at this point, four of them are split. Two Democrats, two Republicans, and then the 48th Coastal Orange County, Rohrabacher and Ruda, too close to call. Let me bring in our experts to talk about the results. With us, Fernando Guerra, a Loyola Marymount University professor and director of the Center for the Study of L.A., also a member of our SCPR board. Professor, good to have you with us again. Your thoughts about what we're seeing with these Orange County races?
Well, it's incredibly more and more Democratic every time we take a look at every election cycle for California. I would never have thought this, you know, as little as 6 years ago, but it's been incredible. While there were certainly somewhat of a blue wave, maybe a blue ripple throughout the nation, there was not only a blue wave, but a blue tsunami in California in terms of the statewide elections, legislative elections, et cetera. Democrats did extremely well in California.
Your thoughts about the Los Angeles County Sheriff's race, where, again, that's too close to call, but I think to the surprise of many, the challenger, Alex Villanueva, is just about 5,000 votes ahead of the incumbent, Jim McDonnell. Again, many votes to be counted. We probably won't know who the sheriff is until late next week, but surprised Villanueva is so close.
This is sheriffs in California just don't lose. It's very tough to beat them. This is going to be historic, and it really several trends. Number one, the growth of the Latino vote in L.A. County, the dominance of the Democratic Party. Villanueva had the endorsement. The continuing strength of labor unions in both their money and organization. They played a role in Villanueva's victory. And then the changing narrative in public safety. it's no longer about just fighting crime. It's about, you know, changing the rules and not incarcerating as many people. All those trends, I think, helped Villanueva. And also the fact that he had a ballot designation that also said sheriff. And so all of that, I think, played a role. And the fact that McDonald was never really a personality and able to be a household name. He had a very low name recognition, and even though he outspent Villanueva in L.A. County with so many races going on, he needed a lot more money to dominate the airwaves, and it just didn't come close.
Caltech political science professor Michael Alvarez, let's talk about Orange County. Here we saw the district attorney's race won by Todd Spitzer, who had actually worked with Tony Rakakis, the incumbent DA, in the past. But Spitzer, 6 percentage points ahead of Rakakis. I don't know if you'd call that an upset, but again, for a longtime DA to lose, particularly rather decisively, that may be a surprise.
Yeah, and I think that Fernando put his finger on something very important, which is I think that in California and also across the nation, we are seeing a change in the public narrative about public safety, right? We're seeing many more challenges in sheriff's races, in district attorney's races. We're also seeing it in elections for justices and for court officials. So I think the public perceptions of these elections and these contests are changing, and I think we're seeing that there are many more challengers who are willing to step up and to go after incumbent sheriffs and DAs.
In Orange County, where's that? There was actually a race for the sheriff's office there. There was thought that Don Barnes, the undersheriff, sort of handpicked by Sheriff Sandra Hutchins, might have won the primary, but he ended up just shy of that. However, he was a pretty easy winner in the general yesterday. Barnes, 57% to challenger Duke Nguyen's 43%. I say challenger. Barnes wasn't technically the incumbent, but was almost running as though he was because of his close professional relationship with Sandra Hutchins. Want to talk about what we saw in the ballot proposition. Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst. Sean, your thoughts about the gas tax repeal going down to defeat and the expansion of rent control going down to defeat in California. Surprised by either?
Not surprised by either. I mean, those were the two races or two ballot propositions that were supposed to drive both Democrats and Republicans to the polls. I think, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if one of the groups tries to sue the attorney general for the ballot designation for the gas tax. It was very, very confusing. But, you know, that said, roads are in terrible shape in California, and I think people want to see them repaired. With regards to rent control, I think the bottom line was that there were too many mom and pops who rent out their rooms. And that was just a bridge too far. So the two kind of partisan issues that were supposed to drive voters just didn't materialize the way I think the parties wanted them to.
Day before the election, when we were talking, your analysis was that it wouldn't likely be a blue wave, but I think you said blue tornadoes, where it was sort of targeted Democratic gains. Did this unfold as you thought it likely would?
Well, if you want to replay the tape, as they say, I predicted between 4 and 7 pickups for Republicans in the U.S. Senate. I think that's probably going to come out around 4, possibly 5. And that's fairly unprecedented. That's the first time in 100 years that Republicans will have 55 seats. With regards to the House, it turned out about what I think I predicted. I think you're going to see probably a 15 to 17 seat majority from the Democrats. And I think, Larry, what is really telling and what Pelosi said in her comments is the fact that they are so close and the seats that they picked up are in places like Texas and Arizona that tend to be a little bit more conservative, that she has to play it a little bit more nonpartisan if she wants to hold those seats, number one. And number two, it's going to be interesting to see whether the real activist group in the Democratic Party fight with her with regards to her more moderate rhetoric both last night and in her press conference today.
Yeah, Michael Alvarez, just quick final thought on the national takeaway from the election.
Again, as I said at the beginning of the show, I think there's a lot here that both sides can look to. And I think, you know, the Republicans made these strong gains in the Senate. I think the Democrats, again, took the House with a very slight majority. And the Democrats also appear poised to pick up some of these important governor's seats, too, across the country. So, you know, it's a real mixed election. The referendum on Trump, I think, is kind of had a mixed result.
All right. Michael Alvarez, thank you so much for joining us this morning, as well as all night last night with our election coverage.
Great.
We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Caltech professor of political science, Michael Alvarez, joining us. Our thanks to Fernando Guerra, professor at Loyola Marymount University, political scientist and director of the Center for the Study of L.A. at LMU, a member of our SCPR Board of Trustees. And our thanks to Republican political analyst Sean T. Walsh as well. Coming up in just a minute, a statewide call-in program, part of our California Dream collaboration. I'll be hosting it from right here in Southern California.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by December 1st to be considered for a $2,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles, this is the California election the day after, a statewide special. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. We're bringing together public radio stations up and down California, as well as the nonprofit news organization Cal Matters, in a California Dream collaborative special. You've just heard on many of these stations Democratic leader in the House Nancy Pelosi with her news conference talking about the Democratic agenda now that the party has taken the majority in the House of Representatives. Immediately prior, President Trump, in a lengthy news conference, had rather combative back and forth with reporters and touted what he saw as an overall win for his policies as Republicans added to their members in the Senate. However, the Democrats, of course, taking the majority in the House of Representatives. For the next hour on our special program, we'll take a look at the election results here in California, and we'll open up our phone lines for you to join us and have a conversation throughout California on the issues that matter to you most. We've, of course, seen California take a very confrontational approach, both Governor Jerry Brown, the legislature, with the Trump administration. Now with Governor-elect Gavin Newsom, what would you like to see as California's future role? Would you like to see it move in a more progressive direction and to take even more of an oppositional stance against the Trump administration? Or do you think the state does that at its peril? Our phone lines are open for you to join us at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. We look forward to hearing from you wherever you are, from the Mexican border all the way to far northern California, with multiple stations picking up our California Dream statewide broadcast. Well, let's begin with Governor-elect Gavin Newsom. He spoke in Los Angeles last night to his supporters in what was as much a campaign speech as a victory speech.
It's time to roll the credits on the politics of chaos and the politics of cruelty. Now is time for going far and going together. Now is the time for decency, for facts, for trust, and now is the time for truth. Now is time for leaders to lead. And to those agents of anger determined to divide us instead of unite us, it's time to pack it up and for you to pack it in. This, in every way, shape, or form, is California's moment. And to those who wonder whether polarization is permanent, who think today's big dreams are tomorrow's broken promises, who question whether a 40 million person melting pot of different faiths, different families, and futures can live and prosper together, California is your answer.
That's Governor-elect Gavin Newsom addressing supporters at his event last night in downtown Los Angeles. It was a good night overall for Democrats in the Golden State, as we saw every statewide office won by a Democrat, and typically by a large margin. The only exception, State Insurance Commissioner, where at this point the Democrat Ricardo Lara has a 2 percentage point lead over Steve Poizner, the former State Insurance Commissioner, and at that time he was a Republican. Poizner running as a no-party preference candidate. We still have 3% of the vote yet to be counted statewide. About 100,000 votes separate Lara and Poizner at this point. So, again, Democrats coming out very strong position here in California. With us is Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio in Sacramento, Ben Adler. Ben, good morning.
Good morning, Larry. Good to be with you.
So no surprise that Democrats came through so strong in the statewide offices. But your thoughts about what we heard from Governor-elect Newsom last night as he comes right out of the gate with what sounded much like a campaign speech.
Well, he really didn't get into specifics of what we can expect from him as governor. And so that was striking. He sought to portray his victory as a clear message to the rest of the country against President Trump. I would suggest that a clear victory for a Democratic candidate for governor in a very blue state like California, maybe not, you know, the biggest news of the night, but that Newsom really wanted to plant his flag and say, you know, this is a mandate and this is, you know, California has spoken. But significantly, the control of the state legislature is solidified in the hands of Democrats. It looks like not just in the assembly, but also, and this was a question, the state Senate, Democrats are going to have 2/3 supermajorities. And so there really is a lot of fertile ground for Democrats as a new era begins at the state capitol. And I think California's politics are going to shift even more to the left as a result. And so we didn't get that clear policy from the governor-elect last night, but he has been clear on the campaign trail of some of the things that he would like to do.
Well, and specifically single-payer health care in California, that's something that he's talked a great deal about. It has had a contentious battle to get through the state legislature, but with the supermajority you described, Democrats could potentially move a single-payer plan through that the governor could sign. What are the thoughts about the prospects for passage of that?
Well, I think a single-payer bill would require a 2/3 supermajority because there would need to be some sort of funding source with it, and likely a ballot measure as well. And just because they have 2/3 doesn't mean that they're going to be able to get every single Democratic member of the legislature to vote for something like that. So I think we shouldn't jump too much to conclusions. And beyond that, as Newsom himself points out, you would need to get the Trump administration approval to do single-payer health care. And that is, I would say, let's put it kindly, a long shot. So I don't think we're going to get single-payer health care immediately. I do think there's going to be some movement seeking to do universal health care, which is to basically leave the existing system in place, maybe look at a public option of sorts, but expand perhaps Medi-Cal to cover folks who aren't covered now, or potentially to folks who could choose to use the state exchange but can't afford it. But, you know, it's just too expensive. They can't afford it.
We're talking with Capitol Public Radio's Bureau Chief in Sacramento, Ben Adler, talking about yesterday's election results. Gavin Newsom, the governor-elect in California, what sorts of initiatives might he push as a difference with outgoing Governor Jerry Brown? We're also asking you, as a public radio listener here in California, to weigh in on what you want to see California's ongoing role versus the federal government. Would you like to see California continue or intensify its setting itself up in opposition to the Trump administration? Or do you think that that would not be the best way for California to go? Would you like to see the state move in a different direction? That's 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. With us in Temecula, listening on KPBS San Diego, Larry, welcome to our statewide program. Your thoughts about the state's future. Larry, are you there? All right. We'll try and get Larry on momentarily. Let's talk with Josh in Brentwood, listening to KPECC Los Angeles. Josh, go right ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on. I really hope that our future is socially progressive, but yet fiscally conservative. I hope that our taxes don't go up, but I also believe in diverting resources toward education, healthcare, and public transportation and infrastructure.
Do you have any concerns with Governor Brown leaving office, his comparative fiscal conservatism for a Democrat, with Gavin Newsom, that California is going to end up spending more?
I do have some concerns about that. I do think that on the flip side, Governor Brown was a little bit more on the side of insurance companies and corporations, a little bit more than I would have liked, and less on the side of consumers. I think with Gavin Newsom, we'll get more of a consumer advocate, but I am worried that we might get more spending and higher taxes, and that does worry me.
Josh, appreciate the call. Josh from Brentwood, listening to KPECC Los Angeles. We're looking forward to calls throughout California, listeners from the Oregon state line all the way to the Mexican border and out to the desert, Central Valley regions of California, rural parts of the state. We welcome all of you to take part in our conversation as we look to California's future in the wake of yesterday's election results. Let's see, we have Tammy in Point Loma, San Diego, listening to KPBS, says, I'm an immigrant from Canada, married to an American Marine. I think Governor-elect Newsom should work with the GOP. We're very tolerant in California, and that's something missing from the national conversation. We should lead by example. Hillary from Oakland Hills, listening to KPBS, I'm sorry, to KQED, San Francisco, says, I'd like all our congressmen and leaders to focus on solving our carbon dioxide problems. Global warming is our most important issue. And of course, Hillary, that's an issue in which Governor Brown has really been at the forefront, pushing California, going it alone on more stringent climate control issues, emission controls, to say if the federal government's not going to do it, we will do it here in California. 866-893-5722. Kay, listening on KPECC, joins us from Chatsworth. Kay, your thoughts about where you want to see Governor-elect Newsom and the state go?
Well, I really like the job that Brown has done, and I like that he has put aside a rainy day fund. My concern with Gavin Newsom, even though I did vote for him, I wanted Villaraigosa to be the candidate, but he wasn't, so I voted for Gavin. And I'm very concerned that he's going to just raid the rainy day fund and not be focused on the fact that not all good times are ahead. So that is a concern of mine.
All right. Thank you, Kay. Listening in Chatsworth over KPCC Los Angeles. Dave in San Francisco, tuned in to KQED, says, I think California really needs to lead the nation. I'd like Governor-elect Newsom to address high rents in California's urban areas, as well as income inequality. And Margo in Sacramento says, I think we need to be willing to have nuanced discussions about real solutions and not just chalk up votes. That's Margo, listening Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. We're on throughout the state in this hour. It's a special California election the day after. It's Project of the California Dream, a collaboration of California's public radio stations and the CalMatters nonprofit news organization. Back in a minute. From NPR member station KPCC Los Angeles, this is a special statewide program, California Election the Day After. I'm Larry Mantle. It's a pleasure to have you with us this morning. This is one of the rare opportunities to bring together Californians statewide to talk about the election results yesterday, a big day for Democrats, including the election of Gavin Newsom, former mayor of San Francisco, as the governor-elect. We're spending this hour not just looking at yesterday's results, but looking forward. How would you like to see California position itself versus the rest of the country? What kind of a leadership role would you like to see the state take? And what are your biggest issues of concern moving forward? It's a supermajority in the state legislature for Democrats. All of the statewide offices are in Democratic hands. The possible exception, state insurance commissioner, whether that race is still too close to call. And we welcome your calls right now at 866-893-5722. Max in Stockton, listening to Valley Public Radio, says, with Democrats only holding the House, if California puts up a fight, can we make sure it's in the best interests of the country and California, not just the best interests of our state? And we have Asjay listening in Santa Barbara to KPCC Los Angeles, says, I hope California makes an effort to work with the Trump administration. I worry what could happen if Sacramento only devotes itself to resisting. Now joining our conversation from NPR member station KQED San Francisco, state and government reporter Marisa Lagos. Marisa, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Your thoughts, first of all, on the ballot propositions that we saw here in California, where we saw the rent control measure, Proposition 10, go down to a big defeat, and Prop 6, which would have repealed the gas tax, also a big loser. A surprise for you?
Not really. You know, I think that the gas tax had been trailing in recent polls, and Republicans who put that on the ballot, I think in large part in hopes to drive up turnout in especially those key congressional races, many of which are still undecided, really had kind of abandoned this campaign. We saw folks like Mimi Walters in Orange County, who had been challenged by a Democrat, help raise money to get this on the ballot, but really having to focus on their own races. And I think that, you know, the state of the roads in California is pretty abysmal, and people might have reacted to that. And, you know, the voter statement that was written by the attorney general, conservatives were pretty unhappy with. It didn't actually mention the gas tax. So not a huge surprise. I think Prop 10, the rent control measure, is a little more interesting. This was also trailing pretty badly in the polls. And it looks like it's going to go, you know, about 60-40 for the no side. I think this one speaks to the sort of tortured relationship Californians have with our housing market and sort of what the right solutions are. We saw in polls that people said in theory, in concept, they like rent control. But this one, you know, had a lot of money against it. I think the realtors and developers and other interests really outspent their opponents by quite a bit. And, yeah, you know, I think it just never caught fire. There was a lot of pretty powerful ads that the opponents were putting out talking about what this would do to property values in California. And it just didn't seem like the yes side ever really had a lot of momentum behind them.
Marisa, you've done a lot of coverage of Governor-elect Gavin Newsom. What's your sense of the issues he's most likely to want to take on out of the gate?
Well, I think Gavin Newsom's challenge is going to be whittling these down to a realistic kind of set of policy goals for his first term. You know, he's talked a lot on the trail about early childhood education and this idea that sort of investing in kids, something like universal preschool, could really help California financially down the road, even though it would cost money at the front. Ben, of course, talked about this issue of single-payer health care. I think that, you know, Newsom is, for a number of reasons, mostly Trump being in the White House and the fact that it is extremely expensive, really going to tackle this issue of healthcare piecemeal. I would expect him to be a little bit more open to some of the measures around expanding coverage that Jerry Brown has not agreed to sign, like, say, to undocumented immigrants and other populations. And then, you know, I think it remains to be seen that to some extent how much of his agenda is sort of dictated by how he's received in Sacramento by lawmakers. We've had a lot of deference to Jerry Brown over the past few years. And I think that, you know, we're seeing after some sort of back and forth between Speaker Anthony Rendon and Gavin Newsom over health care earlier this year. They seem to have sort of mended fences. I know Rendon was at his party last night in Los Angeles. And so I think that some of it will be looking at, you know, obviously how he leads, but also how the legislature kind of responds to him.
We're talking with Marisa Lagos, NPR member station KQED San Francisco. Andrew in Simi Valley, listening to KPCC, says the liberal landslide in California isn't only a protest against the Trump administration, but also a rebuke of the larger nationalist movement, not just in the U.S., but also in Europe. We are the moral beacon of the West. That's Andrew in Simi Valley. Max in Stockton, listening in on Valley Public Radio, says Democrats. I read that point about important to work for the both the state of California and the federal government. Let me take another call. This is from Sonoma County, Camp Meeker, listening on KQED. Amy, good to have you with us on our statewide program.
Great. Thanks for having me. I'm really wanting to see California be progressive and be an example to the nation, because my concern is that if we don't, if we're not able to find solutions for health, housing, education, and wealth inequality in California and demonstrate solutions to the nation is just going to keep going to the right. We really, I think, are on deck to show that we can crack these problems. And Gavin Newsom, you know, it's a tall order, but we have, you know, we have a lot of wealth and a lot of poverty, and we have many issues in housing in Sonoma County. We had the fires last year. We still have people that are homeless. You know, we just have a huge issue with rents.
Do you have a specific proposal that you'd like to see the governor-elect carry out right out of the gate that addresses this concern of yours?
I would just like to see him continue to push for progressive issues like Brown has with the environment and with housing. I'd like to see especially our water issues in California approached in a eye towards ending fossil fuel use. The other thing I'd really like to see him address is the prison complex in California, which many people don't know how many prisons we have in California, which seems counter to a progressive agenda. Also, with our education, like, there's no reason why California shouldn't have the finest education in the world through 2 years of the junior college and have statewide health coverage. So,
all right. Amy, thanks very much. A lot there. We appreciate your call from Sonoma County, Camp Meeker, listening on KQED. Again, we are talking with listeners throughout California on public radio stations up and down the state. A chance for you to weigh in on the future of California given the results of yesterday's statewide election. Our phone number, 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. Joining us now from KPECC, Los Angeles NPR station, Orange County reporter Jill Replogle. Jill, good to have you with us. We had these very hotly contested Orange County congressional races, demographic shifts in Orange County at play. Also, Hillary Clinton winning a number of these districts over Donald Trump 2 years ago. So let's take a look at them. One of them, the 39th district, which is in North Orange County, parts of L.A. and San Bernardino counties. Young Kim appears that she's going to be the first Asian-American woman to become member of the House.
Possibly. She's got a 2.6 percentage point lead right now. I mean, these races are so close, and there are still a bunch of ballots to be counted, 418,000, according to the OC Registrar's website. So, you know, it's too early to call it, but that would be historic. And she has run a strong campaign. And, you know, that was one of the races that didn't look as close as some of the others last night.
So she has the lead over Gil Cisneros, the Democrat there. That's the race, the seat that Ed Royce, the Republican, had represented. In the 45th district, this has been a Republican district seemingly for eternity, right in the heart of Orange County. Mimi Walters, the Republican incumbent, 4 percentage points ahead of Democratic challenger Katie Porter, a UC Irvine law professor. So it looks like Republicans poised to hold that seat in Orange County.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are kind of surprised by that one, especially because Mimi Walters has been largely absent from this campaign. That's kind of been her strategy to, not hold press conferences, not to talk to reporters. And maybe it worked for her. She seems to be doing well. And, I think a lot of people went out for Katie Porter from across Southern California, but it she's not looking good right now.
Tremendous amount of money spent in all of these races, and Democrats heavily outspending Republicans.
Yes, there was a ton of money in that. It was kind of funny. I was at Democrat Harley Ruta's watch party last night in the 48th district. And, one of the things that he said in his speech to supporters there was that he wants campaign finance reform. And then over at Rohrabacher's party, Dana Rohrabacher, the incumbent Republican in that district, he noted that he had been vastly outspent by the Democrats and still was, poised to potentially take the seat. But that one's really close.
That is so close. That's the one that is most undecided. The 48th district, Harley Ruta, 51%, incumbent Republican Dana Rohrabacher with 49%. But just under 3,000 votes separate these two candidates, with many votes yet to be counted. Rohrabacher, a 30-year incumbent in this seat. And then we have Mike Levin, the Democrat. Looks like he is prevailing in the 49th district. Now, only two-thirds of the votes have been counted, but what's left are the San Diego County votes, which would be expected to break more for Levin than Diane Harkey, the Republican, 7,000 votes that are between them in that race.
Yeah, he actually has the biggest margin right now of any of those contested races. And, I think demographics does play into that one a lot. There is a quite large Latino population in northern San Diego County. And, the former, not quite former, but Congressman Issa, who is stepping down, he was just barraged with protest constantly for the last couple of years. And it really brought out the Democrats and the progressives in that district. And, I think they carried that momentum up to Election Day.
Speaking of San Diego, joining us from KPBS San Diego, investigative reporter Amitha Sharma. Amitha, we're just talking about this race in northern San Diego, southern Orange County, where Mike Levin holds the lead over Diane Harkey. Share with us a little bit about how contested this was and Issa's reading of the tea leaves that he probably couldn't win re-election.
Well, it was highly contested, as Jill mentioned. I mean, he was really hit with protests left and right. I mean, those protesters wanted to drive him out of office. And, you had a lot of Democratic contestants in the June primary. Diane Harkey in that primary got a majority of the vote. However, yesterday, as you can see, it looks like Levin is going to take that seat, the Democratic environmental attorney. He's going to take that seat. And he's going to be a very different kind of congressional representative for that district. This is a district, understand, that has predominantly more Republicans than Democrats. And when Issa was representing it, he was a real thorn in the side for Democrats. Now, Levin is an environmental attorney. Climate change is very close to his heart. This is something that he's going to talk a lot about once he is sworn in. So you're going to have very different representation. What's interesting also about this district is, as I said, Republicans outnumber Democrats in the 49th Congressional District. And then to the south, to the east, we have the 50th Congressional District, where Republicans also outnumber Democrats. And there we had Republican incumbent Duncan Hunter, who was under criminal indictment for allegedly misspending campaign funds. He has beaten his Democratic challenger, Amar Campa Najjar.
That a tough task, not just because the voter registration you mentioned in that district, but Campa Najjar, not particularly well known. That was an uphill battle. despite, as you say, the federal indictment alleging $250,000 in personal expenditure of campaign funds by Hunter and his wife. So that the legal disposition of that, of course, is to come. And that does put a cloud over the seat, even though Hunter wins re-election. Amitha, thanks so much for sharing with us the latest updates on those San Diego County congressional races. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
One other big race going up to the Central Valley is where incumbent Republican Jeff Denham was challenged by Josh Harder, a Democrat who had ties to Silicon Valley. And there we see just over 1,000 votes separating the two, the incumbent Republican Denham in the lead. Ben Adler, Capital Bureau Chief, Capital Public Radio, Sacramento. Quick thought on this with Denham, because this is a seat Democrats thought they had a shot to take.
And they may still. I think this is perhaps the seat that might take one of the longest to resolve. I think it's pretty clear that Democrats are going to pick up the Mike Levin win in the Darrell Issa district in San Diego. And it looks like Dana Rohrabacher may have his 30-year era in Congress come to an end with Harley Reuter winning in that coastal Orange County district. And Steve Knight in the northern Los Angeles area, Palmdale, is trailing by about 4,000 votes. And with Republicans feeling a little bit better about the Mimi Walters district and also the Young Kim victory and Ed Royce's district in the Fullerton area, that really leaves the Jeff Denham seat as the one that's closest. A couple thousand or maybe just 1,000 votes apart right now. And well, let's see here. Quick math, always dangerous. Looks like around 1,300 votes is the lead for Jeff Denham right now, just over 1% over Democrat Josh Harder. So there's certainly the ability for Democrats to come back and pick that one up in the late vote by mail ballots getting counted in the provisional ballots. We're going to be waiting, possibly for weeks.
It could be. We should also mention the 25th Congressional District, North Los Angeles County, a portion of Ventura County, and the Democratic challenger here, Katie Hill, a couple points up in this race with Steve Knight, the incumbent Republican in this race. Hill not only has had a huge amount of financial support from Democrats, she also was part of the Vice political coverage on HBO, which followed her around. Very, very high profile for Katie Hill in that race. She's up 2 percentage points. But again, many votes still to be counted in these races. Let's take another listener call from San Clemente, listening on KPBS San Diego. April, what do you want to see here in the future with California's elected representatives?
Hi, I was calling. My concern is the transparency and accountability to everyone who's been elected to show us what they're actually doing with all the taxes that they do collect, all the revenue that's collected. And I feel like a lot of times people get really upset at the idea of paying all this and not getting much back in return that they can see, especially certain classes. And they feel like, oh, everyone below a certain level is getting all the benefits, and then all this anger happens. And you can tell that mostly people want to help, because they usually say okay to a new tax if it's for the environment, if it's for a school. But then they get so angry knowing they can barely live here with all the taxes they're paying, and they're never seeing the benefit. And I just want to see that transparency of the budget. And where are these dollars going? What deals are being made?
All right, April, thank you so much. Listening to KPBS and calls us from San Clemente. You're listening to the California Election the Day After, a statewide special of the California Dream Project, a collaboration of California's public radio station and the nonprofit Cal Matters. Back in 1 minute. From NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles, this is the California Election the Day After, a statewide special, a collaboration of the California Dream Project of California public radio stations and Cal Matters. I'm Larry Mantle of KPCC, and we're hearing from listeners up and down California sharing what they would like to see as California's position with the federal government. Would you like to see Governor-elect Gavin Gavin Newsom become even more intensified and progressive movement in the State House and moving in greater opposition to the Trump administration? Or do you think that would be a mistake? What would you like to see legislatively in the future? California, of course, has positioned itself at this point as being, if not the most progressive, certainly one of the most progressive states in the U.S. The question is, do you want to see that trend continue? And if so, in what ways? If not, what would you like to see the state retreat from? 866-893-5722. BZ joins us from the Sierra foothills of Tuolumne, listening on Capital Public Radio. BZ, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for letting me be on the air.
Go right ahead, please.
So my concern is, as a strategic plan for economic development in the rural areas of California, we need to take a look at how we can expand broadband access into areas like mine and Sierra Foothills and other rural areas of California. This would then expand opportunities for jobs in the tech sector. And in the process of doing that, it would create a very large demographic shift in our state that then might be able to help create a climate where there is more diversity and a greater sense of the progressive goals that would then the voters in areas like mine would realize that we could help facilitate this dream.
You live in one of the most beautiful parts of the state where there's so many natural attractions for people to live and potentially to work there if there were jobs. What would you see the state could do to help create the jobs in your community? Is it a matter of regulation? Is it job training programs, incentives to businesses to relocate to the Sierra foothills? What would make the difference?
The thing that we're seeing in our community that is immediate and most critical is the actual access to improved broadband access, where the internet services expand and get better. And then after that, I think it is the recruitment of industries to come to our area through economic development. And then following that, the educational training access.
BZ, thank you so much. Good to have you joining us from Tuolumne in the Sierra foothills, listening to Capital Public Radio in our statewide broadcast. With us now from CalMatters, the nonprofit news organization, one of the partners in the California Dream Project, is a housing reporter, Matt Levin. Matt, good morning. Let's talk first about rent control. Given the defeat of Proposition 10 and the huge margin of defeat there, do you think it leaves open other avenues at the state level for expanding rent control?
So this is something that Gavin Newsom has actually talked about already. Gavin Newsom opposed Prop 10, although that was not prominently featured in the No on 10 advertising. But he has said that he would like to reach some type of compromise on rent control. I think the real question coming out of this election now is how much leverage do the landlords and the realtors and developers who spent heavily on the measure, how much leverage do they now have with this initiative losing by, 20, 24 points, possibly 25 points? So it'll be interesting to see how kind of negotiates that. Those on the Yes on 10 side have also been deeply skeptical of Newsom's willingness to broker a deal.
All right. And given that this is going to limit what states can potentially do on the issue, what are some of the other things that Newsom has said about regulation when it comes to housing starts, other ways to incentivize the creation of more housing, either denser in urban areas or in some of the more suburban open space areas, perhaps environmental relief for construction of single family homes? Is that on the table?
Yes, that's definitely on the table. So Newsom has described himself as a fan of big, hairy, audacious goals. And I don't think anything in his campaign platform is bigger or more audacious or more hairy than his housing plan, which is to lead the effort to construct 3.5 million new units of housing over the next 10 years. That's a pace that California, a construction pace that California hasn't reached since they've basically started keeping track of those statistics. He has talked about, in relatively specific detail, rolling back some regulations for new housing development, especially around public transit. He's also talked about taking away some powers from cities and counties to approve new housing. Those are very tough sells to get done in the legislature up here in Sacramento. It'll be a tough battle for him.
All right. We're talking with Matt Levin, CalMatters reporter covering housing. Matt, thank you so much. We appreciate your joining us. Let's take another listener call. This is from Redwood City on the peninsula, listening to KQED San Francisco. Greg, your thoughts on the future of California?
Good morning. I really hope the new leadership can really put aside the California propaganda machine and deal with our really incredible systemic problems. Like now California is now the fifth largest economy in the world, but one third of the population is below the poverty line and on social services. So really, closing that gap of income inequality and giving people access to a way out of public services. Dealing with the climate, California has more cars on the road than anybody else in the country, and the worst air quality. So I really hope that, the leadership can address that with, better mass transit and get people out of their cars.
All right. I appreciate it. Greg in Redwood City, listening to KQED. And we have some national news to share with you. President Trump has just tweeted, "We are pleased to announce Matthew G. Whitaker, Chief of Staff to Attorney General Jeff Sessions at the Department of Justice, will become our new acting Attorney General of the United States. He will serve our country well. We thank Attorney General Jeff Sessions for his service and wish him well. A permanent replacement will be nominated at a later date." So just after the conclusion of his more than hour-long news conference, President Trump via tweet announcing that Jeff Sessions is stepping down as Attorney General. There'll be more details, of course, that'll be coming up on NPR's All Things Considered this afternoon, as well as NPR Hourly News, a chance for you to get additional details about Jeff Sessions stepping down as U.S. Attorney General. You're listening right now to a special statewide program, the California election the day after. Let's talk next with Enrique, who's at the U.S.-Mexico border in San Ysidro, listening to KPBS. Enrique, what would you like to see here in the future in California?
Yes, hello. So I'm on the border here with Mexico, and I can see that horrible wall in front of me. And I hope that Gavin Newsom, as he has been very supportive of Dreamers and as the new governor coming in, will show the world that it's a blessing to be next to Mexico. These people that are the refugees that are traveling all over the world, not just to the U.S., should be welcomed and treated with kindness and love. Because what Trump has done, he's gotten these people pictured as criminals and animals, and that is so hateful. Our organization, Border Angels, has been around for more than 30 years. We're on the front lines. We put water in.
Okay.
Welcome these caravans, and we hope that Gavin Newsom will show the way to the country, because I know the overwhelming majority of the country is with us.
All right. Enrique, I appreciate it. In San Ysidro, listening to KPBS. Let's head back to KQED country. This is in Santa Rosa. Emily, welcome.
Hi. Well, thank you very much for having your show. It's great. Interest.
Nice to hear Californians talk with each other, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Go right ahead, Emily.
We should do it more often.
All right.
Yeah, well, I probably am in the minority. People are going to be shocked. What I want Gavin Newsom to continue is Jerry Brown's bullet train. I think we need alternative methods to go fast. We've got to be futuristic looking. Taking an airplane to fly is a huge problem with global warming. And a lot of people will fly hither and thither, and they don't realize how much our planet is suffering climate-wise because of airplanes.
All right. So, Emily, the bullet train, you want to see Gavin Newsom continue with support of that. Of course, a signature plan for Governor Jerry Brown as he leaves office. Let me go back to Marisa Lagos of KQED in San Francisco. Marisa, what has Gavin Newsom said about his position on the bullet train?
You know, I would say he has not been super enthusiastic, although he does say he backs it. You know, I think that this is one of those things, as you said, has been a signature issue for Governor Brown, and that Newsom, you know, I think in theory supports. I think he has some concerns about the cost, as a lot of folks do. And, you know, the way the state has been kind of trying to approach this is a bit piecemeal so that they can get portions built and sort of, I think, build some political capital off of, you know, an increased amount of transportation around the state. But that twin tunnels, Gavin Newsom has said he's not wild about, another sort of signature issue of Brown's. And so, you know, they're both Democrats. I don't think Gavin Newsom wants to come into office and by any means sort of blow up anything that Brown has been doing. But he is going to leave his own mark. And I think that he is a lot more focused on the sort of programs over the infrastructure that Brown has focused on. Again, you know, things like early childhood education. He's been on the Board of Regents as the lieutenant governor. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how the universities respond. Brown has really held the line on their spending. So, I think that these differences will become more apparent in the first year of this administration as we see sort of whether his tepid support for something like the bullet train, although, you know, he has been defending it, I will say, lately. But he's kind of waffled back and forth on that.
All right. Marisa Lagos with us from KQED San Francisco. Anders tweets, I'd like to hear more from our new governor on the bullet train and how we might lower the risks from cost overruns and underutilizing costly new infrastructure. That's Anders tweeting, joining us on our statewide program. Guillermo in Oakland, listening to KQED, says, I think California can take the lead, showing the country that immigrants make our state stronger and benefit the economy. With the rhetoric going on across the country, it would be healing. Let's talk next with John in Glendale, listening to KPCC. John, how would you like to see California position itself versus the federal government?
Hi. Hey, great to be on. One of the most underemphasized factors, I think, for California as a state and its strength as a state is the community college system. And I think that was evident in Newsom's speech yesterday or this morning, where he was basically saying that, you know, we're a very diverse cast of characters here in California. And I can think of no better place that diversity comes to a crux or a head than in a community college. So I would love to see it if there was a focus on making sure that community colleges have an economic protection set in place just in case the economy has a downturn, that we can make sure as a state to keep students educated and keep them in the process of their education, as well as keep educators and administrators hired and employed so that overall morale can be high and that the process can keep as fluid as possible.
All right, John, thanks so much. That's John in Glendale listening to KPCC Los Angeles. Max tweets, I don't want the state to participate in any further slide to the right. Republicans owe California recompense, talking about the state and local tax being limited for deduction before we even talk working with them. As is, we pay too much in federal taxes without adequate representation. Max tweeting, he's listening to KPCC Los Angeles. Lauren also listening to KPCC, calls from Pasadena, say, I'd like to see California's new governor look at the homelessness problem, especially among aged out foster youth. And Dan tweets, California has saved $9 billion. Many Americans believe the liberal agenda is too expensive. Governor-elect Newsom can profile a different message as to how liberalism can work positively. That's Dan tweeting our statewide program. Matt is listening in Napa to KQED. Matt, what would you like to see for the future of California?
I think, yeah, as a long-term Democratic Party activist, one of the things that seems to be happening in the background is now that Republicans are pretty much neutralized in the state of California, Democrats in the state really have been moderating and moving to the right. Very good example here in the Napa area, we have a state senator who ran for the legislature a few years ago. Prior to that, he had been a Republican all his life, realized he wasn't going to get anywhere as a Republican, so became a Democrat. One, and really has proven to be very corporate friendly. And I think there's a lot of disaffection in the state, particularly among progressives, about that. I think California could be a really fertile ground for the rise of a new party. I think at the national level, there's frustration with the two-party duopoly. I think we kind of find ourselves in the Trump mess because of the failings of the two major parties. So I think there's a lot of energy among progressives. I'm seeing a lot of at the local level for a real, true progressive party. I think California could see that now that you've got really Democratic Party domination, but a lot of disaffection within the party in terms of the very corporatist, moderate Democrats and the real progressives. I think that's going to be an interesting thing to watch over the next few years.
Matt, thanks so much. Calling us from Napa, listening to KQED. David, in Westwood, listening to KPCC, I'd like to see the new California lawmakers representing the Republican minority. They need to make sure that they're not left out. And Fed Up writes on our webpage, I'd like to see a major revision to CEQA, the State Environmental Quality Act. The process only drives up expenses, delays projects, and does little to protect the environment, as the jurisdiction authority usually just declares overriding considerations. Another factor is the cumulative effect of multiple small projects that don't get mitigated because they're considered insignificant in the reports. That's Fed Up saying wants to see CEQA, the Environmental Quality Act, revisited here in California. Also want to remind you that you can tweet your ongoing commentary on the future of California in the wake of yesterday's election wins. Please use the hashtag CADREAM. That's for California Dream, this project which brings together California's public radio stations and CalMatters, the nonprofit statewide news organization. That's CADREAM for you to tweet your comments on it. Also want to take this opportunity as we close to thank the terrific team of individuals that brought this together, our colleagues at our member station of the California Dream Project, KPBS in San Diego, KPCC Los Angeles, KQED San Francisco, and Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Also terrific to be able to talk with you in the Central Valley today and in far northern California as well. The California Dream Series is a statewide media collaboration of CalMatters and all those public radio stations I mentioned, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the James Irvine Foundation. Just want to reiterate that in California, statewide offices, Democrats swept the board. The exception state insurance commissioner there, Ricardo Lara, the Democrat, with a very small lead over Steve Poizner, no party preference candidate, and it may take several days to determine that election result. Otherwise, Democrats sweeping, a split of the statewide ballot propositions, but the two highest profile state ballot measures, Proposition 6, the gas tax repeal goes down to defeat Proposition 10, which would have removed certain limits on rent control at the local level. That, too, goes down to defeat. Have a great day.